Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's May the 29th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
I've been hearing Mr. Covington speak about the white character issue for some time. I was wanting a definition of what he meant, and I found a list of things I think address this issue. White folk virtues. Courage. My fear does not keep me from defending my folk, my family, or myself. I conquer my fear. Discipline. I control my mind, will, and emotions. I do, of my own accord, what needs to be done. Fidelity. I keep the vows I make, especially those to folk, family, and self. Honor. I keep pure the name and honor of my folk, family, and self. Hospitality. For folk and family, I willingly share my food, hearth, and shelter. Industriousness. I perform my tasks with joy and honor, holding nothing back. Perseverance. I continue until I've met my obligations and my goals. Self-reliance. I support my folk, my family, and myself. I depend only on myself. I strengthen the independence of the folk and family. Truth. I search for and embrace the truth. When speaking the truth may harm my folk or family, I keep silent. Live with courage and honor, comrades.
That was Comrade Steve from Michigan. Get used to that short piece, because you're going to be hearing it a lot on this show from now on. Now, first off, I'd like to mention that we had a great little get-together up here in the Pugetopolis on Memorial Day Monday. We met with some of our comrades from down in Oregon, and I had the pleasure of watching multiple young white children running around and playing, which is something you seldom see at the typical right-wing rubber chicken dinner in a rented motel banquet room, where it's mostly gray heads, and the only children running around are the little brown bambinos belonging to the Mexican staff. I had the wonderful experience of being scowled at by a baby. Many thanks to those who attended from across the water and drove all the way up from Portland. Secondly, a quick Northwest employment note. I had a guy come by yesterday who was up in the Silverdale Mall, and he gave me a leaflet from the Sears and Roebuck up there to the effect that Sears was now hiring, offering all the usual glittering inducements, paid training and health care of some kind, blah, 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 blah. Now, I'm not saying that you need to pack your gear and come rushing up here to the homeland just to stock shelves or sweep the floor at Sears and Roebuck, but I need to tell you that this is actually quite a common occurrence here. This is one of the few parts of this godforsaken country where it is still possible to see help wanted signs in the windows of businesses. Yeah, they're mostly low-wage service jobs unless you have a skill, which is why I keep berating white kids and telling them to quit dicking off in school and get into a technical college and acquire a marketable skill. But there are still jobs here. You do not have to be afraid about getting employment of some kind if you come here. Thirdly, for those of you who don't already know, we're all having a great deal of trouble with Edgar Steele's mail. He's just not getting it. It's either being withheld from him, or else it's being simply thrown in the dumpster, either on orders from the prison administration or just by some nigger guard who's trying to be a dick. In any case, Edgar Steele has literally been sent thousands of letters and commissary donations and publications since he was buried alive in Victorville 2.5 years ago, and he is receiving only the tiniest trickle of it. Now, I'm not sure why he's getting even that tiny trickle of mail, but the fact is that very occasionally a letter does get through or somebody hears from Ed. Now, I guess every now and then the stupider nigger Mexican guards who are on mailroom duty just simply forget that Ed's supposed to be in the cone of silence or whatever, and they absentmindedly give him a letter or a periodical. Or maybe it's a credible deniability thing.
Why, we ain't holding back that old man's mail. Why, we done give a letter to him just 6 weeks ago.
While, of course, still withholding 95% of his actual incoming mail and commissary donations. Now, it's the same thing with outgoing mail. I've gotten one letter from Edgar in the past 2.5 years, wherein he mentions that he has not received one single Northwest Observer that I've sent him in all that time. Now, without getting into details, I have reason to believe that the letter did not leave the prison by the usual channels. Now, nor is this due to Ed being dispirited or suicidal or any of the other strange rumors that have been mysteriously circulating on the white internet from the usual suspicious sources ever since his original arrest. If Ed was all depressed and screw you guys and leave me alone to die, that would explain his lack of correspondence. True, but we now have a couple of our prison comrades close to him who see him almost every day, and they have assured me that this is far from the case. While Ed is in pretty bad health, consistent with the dictatorship's policy of dumping him in Victorville and waiting for him to die of so-called natural causes, i.e. withholding medical treatment, he is in no way depressed, and he's still as feisty and hopeful as ever. He is aware of his mail problems, and he has repeatedly complained about it to his captors, both officially, in writing, and otherwise, and he has been simply ignored. I know that Ed is being officially kept incommunicado from physical visitors, including his wife Cindy, who hasn't seen him in years. But on a guess, I don't think the no-mail policy is official. Now, I have enough experience in dealing with prison correspondents to know that when there is some kind of official embargo on a prisoner's mail privileges, the correspondent usually gets an official document of some kind, either separately or in the envelope when the mail is returned to the sender, stating why the mail was refused. For example, the Coffee Creek Women's Camp used to send back Pam Bailey's mail claiming that there were foreign substances on the envelope, i.e. coffee stains, which were not there when the envelopes were mailed. I was made sure that they were pristine, and which pretty clearly were the result of guards in the mailroom slopping coffee on it deliberately. That kind of thing. But in Edgar Steele's case, the mail is simply disappearing without a trace. Thousands of pieces of mail over the past 4 years, and not just mine either. Everybody has complained about this. Also, in a sinister related development, apparently at least two of the convicts in the Victorville prison who are suspected, rightly or wrongly, of assisting Edgar in communicating with the outside world, including me, have also gone dark on me recently. Somebody is determined that Edgar Steele will be silenced, that he will not speak to anyone outside those walls while he waits there to die. Okay, look, I want to suggest a possible remedy here, but you need to bear in mind that this approaches the line most of you are not willing to cross, i.e. you're going to have to peep out from behind your computers for a bit and reveal your identities to bad people who may try to punish you for daring to stand up for an elderly man that they have marked for death and oblivion. Insolent white people aren't supposed to do that. All of a sudden, I can sense the hanging of heads and the shuffling of the feet and the nervous, surreptitious glancing around for the exits. Now, if the prison authorities in Victorville are withholding Edgar Steele's mail without any notice to the correspondent and without returning it, as appears to be the case, what they are doing is in violation of the Federal Bureau of Prisons' own rules, and it is also illegal. Of course, that's always been the American problem. How do we compel agencies of the dictatorship to obey their own laws? We can't, not without using the constitutional remedy our forefathers supplied us, and we clearly don't have the guts to do that, so the dictator's servants operate absolutely without accountability of any kind. Now, what we can do is what all bureaucrats dread. We can make them work. We can create paper trails. Bureaucrats hate and fear paper trails because there is never any guarantee that they won't lead somewhere. Now, we can create a permanent record of what's happening to Edgar. Even if that permanent record is buried in government files and hard drives, the fact that such a permanent record exists at all anywhere will give the Victorville commandant and whichever of his underlings is messing around with Edgar Steele's mail agita. Maybe enough agita to eventually knock it off and just give the poor old man his mail. Or maybe enough to simply poison Edgar in his cell, or arrange for a bullpen nigger to stab him in a corridor, and yes, there is always that risk. I know Ed would want us to take it and would be willing to face the consequences. So I need you people to start writing letters and sending emails, not just to the Victorville commandant, who will mostly just ignore you. First off, write a certified letter to Edgar J. Steele, Steele, prison number 14226-023. That's number 14226-023. Post Office Box 3900. That's 3900. Adelanto, California. That's Adelanto, Adelanto, California. Zip code 92301. That's 92301. Just say hello to Ed or whatever, but send the letter certified mail so that it can at least be tracked as far as the prison gates. The question then becoming what happens to that letter once it disappears into the bowels of the Victorville mailroom. Now, it could be that the solution is as simple as certifying all Ed's mail, a price that I will willingly pay. In your letter, make sure that you enclose a small check, $5 at least, for Edgar's prison commissary account. This will also have to be recorded and create a separate paper trail. Plus, it will ensure that Ed has the money for paper and pen and envelopes and postage, which is an excuse that is sometimes used when prisoners are held incommunicado. If you do not receive a reply after a reasonable time, say a month, start a tracer on the letter through the post office and write a letter of complaint to, number one, the commandant of the Victorville prison, number two, the postal inspectors, number three, your congressman, number four, the congressman in whatever district Victorville lies. Number five, the Bureau of Prisons. Number six, Amnesty International, who never take the cases of white prisoners, but give it a try anyway. Ditto the ACLU. Search the internet for various prison projects, that kind of thing. Use what is called the multiplier effect. Get other people to write your annoying letters to the Victorville prison authorities for you. Anyone who might make noise and cause bureaucrats anywhere in the prison industrial complex to spend time and paper and computer space dealing with it. Do you see what we need to do here? We need to make continuing to withhold Edgar Steele's mail such a paperwork nuisance for these people and lay so many paper trails that will submerge into the permanent record where they may suddenly surface at inconvenient times in the future that unless the Victorville prison commandant is under specific orders from whoever the hell it is that Edgar Steele pissed off in the first place to get himself arrested on fabricated charges, the commandant will just say, screw this, give the old racist his damned mail from now on. Okay, now, as you know, for the past few weeks, I've been playing some songs by a very strange white nationalist music group called Rapus 8. Now, I don't know who these guys are, but apparently they know me in the Northwest Front, because one of the songs on their CD that I was sent is an homage to Radio Free Northwest. It's our theme song, in fact. This is Rapus 8 doing Rising of the Moon.
Tell me, John O'Farrell, tell me why you do it so. Hustle, buckle, hush, and listen. And it's juice for all the clothes.
Hot air orders from captain. Get you ready, looking soon. For the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon. For the pikes must be together at the rising of the moon. Come and tell me, Donald Phil, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, quite well known to you and me. One more word to signal token, whistle out the marching tune. With the pipe upon your shoulder at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon. With your pipe upon your shoulder at the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin, the eyes are watching through the night. Many a manly heart was beating to the blessed morning light. Murmurs ran along the valleys to the banshee's lonely crew. And a thousand pipes were flashing by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon. And a thousand pipes were flashing by the rising of the moon. All along that singing river, that black mass of men was seen. High above it, shining weapons through their own beloved dream. Death to every foreign traitor, whistle out the marching tune. And hurrah, my boys, for freedom, tis the rising of the moon. It's the rising of the moon, tis the rising of the moon. Hurrah, my boys, for freedom, tis the rising of the moon. Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and full bitter was their fate. Oh, what glorious pride and sorrow fills the name of 98. Yet thank God that in our beating hearts, with manhood's burning new, we will follow in their footsteps at the rising of our moon. By the rising of our moon, by the rising of our moon, we'll follow in their footsteps at the rising of our moon.
Okay, moving right along here, here's Gretchen.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to talk about De Silva's book, The Rise of the West. Now, this book deals with a circular interpretation of history, because De Silva says that the linear interpretation of history is very limiting, and we need to look at history just as we look at nature and we see the cycles in nature. Now, De Silva started out as a Reaganite conservative, and he knows the concerns that conservatives have. One concern that conservatives have, of course, is the Constitution. But De Silva tells us that it's really not fruitful to focus on the Constitution because the only people who can interpret the Constitution or who are allowed to interpret the Constitution in our society is the high priests, and that is the Supreme Court and lawyers. Of course, they will interpret it however they wish. And he tells us that both the Democrats and the Republicans are really multiculturalists. Now, he tells us that at one point in 1985, and he mentions this in the end notes, there was a proposed amendment for the Constitution called the Pace Amendment, which would have reversed the repeal of the National Origins Act. But, of course, the Pace Amendment died in embryo, essentially, because, like any kosher conservative means of reform, was really blocked off from any development. Now, he says that conservatives, even though another issue they often have is gun rights, that the issue is really not gun rights, but it's freedom to maintain a race culture. And he believes that every race culture has a right to self-defense. Now, he reminds us that ours was a nation born in revolt. And just as in the past, he feels that now really the only thing that will save us as a race culture is revolutionary change. And he hopes that there will be an alliance between Europeans and Americans as Westerners. And, of course, if Westerners don't take their future into their own hands, it's going to be decided by others. Because both parties that really are multiculturalists, they really don't allow any territory or even organizations that really will work for white nationalists, because eventually any organizations they allow will be moderate and diverse, and it will cause any remaining whites to be in an environment where eventually they're going to start mixing. And he says that this modern world, this modern society that the West has created, is going to collapse eventually. And he talks about this idea of holding the lightning, and it's very much like the Julius Evola idea of riding the tiger, welcoming the end of this phase of civilization so that a new phase will come about. And he's optimistic that eventually this will happen, and he thinks it's going to happen much like what happened in the Balkans, for example, during the 90s. And he has this dream that people will get involved in homesteading, so it's that dream of moving off to this idealized farm. And people will have to learn to live within their means and understand that the protection of the integrity of their race is primary. The writer says that most people would support nationalists, but they're really too busy with their daily lives, and they don't necessarily have the vision that nationalists do. But there's a certain youth and idealism within nationalism, and he sees this as a very positive quality, a rejuvenating quality. And he also believes that a more homogeneous society is not going to need as many laws. Now, he talks about the propaganda of the deed, and he uses the example of Jesus Christ because he comes from a Christian identity background, even though he sees religion as a tool for social betterment. So he doesn't really believe so much in any religion being ultimately correct, but he sees religion as necessary for society. And he also uses the example of a South African who was pro-white and was a fighter for the white race, and obviously inspired by these examples. I would have to say that I found this book a bit hesitant in the first, I would say, three quarters, and then in the last quarter of the book, it really picks up and becomes a much bolder declaration than it is in the first part. And I don't know if that's because he was writing this book while he was still in prison, and maybe he was constrained in what he could say. Actually, I find it rather amazing that Da Silva is able to write a book like this, because I know he must be under surveillance given his record. So I would call this a companion book to The Foundations of the 21st Century, and I think The Foundations of the 21st Century, for the most part, finds a stronger voice than this book does. I think this book is a process of Da Silva finding a voice, for whatever reason, but they're really both very worthwhile. And I would definitely recommend also reading the endnotes. So I hope you enjoyed this review. I'm sure many of you have read this book. Then again, I'm sure there's some who haven't. And I've already started reading the Broder Schweiden book, and that one's hard to put down because it really, it details certain points of view about the order that is really interesting. So I look forward to reviewing that one next. And just remember that no matter what propaganda you might have seen on television over the Memorial Day weekend, for example, at the end of the day, if the white race doesn't survive, and at this point that looks very iffy, what else do you have? So hail victory, comrades.
On Tuesday, May the 27th, I did a Mike Harris show on Mike's news slot on Revolution Radio. There were some technical problems which dictated that I didn't exactly do a complete show, and also there were some interruptions, so I've decided what I'm going to do is rather than make that show into a whole separate podcast, I'm going to cut that show into pieces and drop the best parts in here to Radio Free Northwest.
Are we on?
No, I'm here.
You're here. I don't know if any. It seems like we're on. I'm going to send a note.
It's on, man.
I hope so. I tell you, this is just making me bat crap crazy. I can't say the S word out here, but I can say other words. Okay, I just have to get a verification from someone outside of my realm that we're back on. I'm just waiting for that to come. So we're going to refrain from what we say. We're not going to get into our dialogue here yet.
Okay.
Hopefully we are. We're back on.
Can't sit and plot the violent overthrow of the United States government.
Well, we can, unless you want to broadcast to hundreds of thousands, which might be the way to go.
Yeah.
All right. It says that we're off again currently. We should be on. It's showing that we're on, but this is making me nuts.
They're coming to take me.
Oh, okay. Okay. Now I've got another thing. We're both on live. Okay. All right. Well, anyway, let me introduce my guest and let's start this over again because this is really like starting an all new radio show again.
All right.
So let me say that this is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. And today is Tuesday, May 27th, 2014. And after a great deal of technical issues and delay, we're back on the air. And my guest today is author and social commentator, Harold Covington. Harold, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm glad to finally be here.
Yeah, well, me too. It's, like I said, these technical issues here are making me nuts. I put my focus into the guest, into the show, and having to do really the mechanics behind the scene. This is something I'm not used to doing, and it's a little tough on me, but I will do the best that I can. And so if my frustration is showing, I apologize to the listeners, but that's just how it is. And Harold, how have you been?
Well, I've been rolling along. I've been dealing with a lot of issues up here that I don't really want to get into at this point with the NF. What's happening, frankly, is that we're starting to make some progress. And with progress comes a lot of assorted BS and problems, personnel nature, financial nature, etc. So I've been keeping busy, put it that way, but otherwise I'm doing fine.
Well, good. So for those who don't know, why don't we tell people what the National Front is, what the NF is?
Northwest Front, actually.
Yeah, the Northwest Front. And how did you come about with this concept? I'm a big proponent of your books. You've written these books about the Northwest Revolution, if you will. And you've written a series of five books now?
Well, there are five books in the Northwest Independence series, the so-called quintet. I've written a total of 20 books. Of various kinds, everything from historical mysteries to historical novels to thrillers, what have you. I'm looking at my bookshelf right now. I see one of the first ones I wrote many years ago. It's called Vindicus. It's a novel of history's first gunfighters, so, Second Amendment people might be interested in that one. But the ones that I'm more or less known for are the five Northwest Independence novels, which deal with an IRA-style insurrection in the Pacific Northwest to establish a homeland in the Pacific Northwest for all of the white peoples of the world. It's something which I believe is within the realm of possibility. And I won't go into a long dissertation on the novels themselves, but basically they each take an aspect of this revolution from a slightly different angle. One, for example, is set in Seattle, a mighty fortress. One in rural western Washington. The Brigade is set largely in Portland and down on the Oregon coast. And the last one, Freedom's Sons, is set primarily in Montana. And it goes through how such a revolution could come about, the tactics, the strategy, the political ideology behind such a revolution. The longest book is the last one. It's called Freedom's Sons. It begins on the day that the revolution becomes successful at what I call the Longview Conference, and it deals with the problem of actually setting up an all-white nation here on the North American continent. And this is something that most movement and most right-wing groups simply have never really dealt with. What are we going to do when we win? What kind of problems is an all-white nation going to face? What kind of opposition are we going to get from the rest of the world? What is our economy going to be like? What is our infrastructure going to be like? What are our military and social and political problems going to be like? And I attempt to deal with that. What Freedom Sons does, basically, it takes the first 50 years of the Northwest American Republic, and it looks at how the new nation develops through the eyes of three families. One was a nationalist family who were part of the NVA, the rebel army during the rebellion. One through the eyes of a unionist family who stayed more or less loyal to the United States, how they have to adjust. And one, a refugee family, of which there will be many when it happens, who had to flee from the United States, from Chicago specifically, with literally nothing but the clothing on their backs to the new Northwest Republic. So that is the most complex of the novels. But the Northwest Front is a political and social movement of people who believe that this can and should be done, that the only way to preserve any kind of remnant of the white American heritage and the white American people is through the physical separation of the races, and that this can only be accomplished in a sovereign nation of our own here on the North American continent. Now, this is predicated on certain ideas. One is that there is going to be a Soviet-style breakup of the United States, which is something I think we're seeing right now before our very eyes. All you have to do is get up in the morning and check on Drudge Report, and you're seeing how slowly but surely the United States and United States power is crumbling. There is going to be a breakup of the North American continent, and probably of Canada too, into separate geographical and political entities, each dealing with or each the property, if you will, of a certain racial and ethnic group. I believe the Mexicans will eventually get what they call Aztlan in the Southwest, including large parts of Texas. The Mexicans, both legal and illegal, are entirely open and honest about their goal here. They are going to take back the Southwest part of the United States from America, and probably as much as they can get elsewhere as well. I believe that the South has become so black and so negrified that it will eventually either become a Republic of New Africa, or else it will simply degenerate into some kind of condition very similar to what West Africa is in right now, and the Horn of Africa, because this is what happens when you have black rule. We see an example of what happens when you have black rule in Detroit right now, and the South will, I'm sorry to say, because I am a Southerner, but I believe the South will eventually become something similar to what we are seeing in sub-Saharan Africa right now, because the population is going to be black, and the white population will simply flee to the Northwest or elsewhere on the continent. There is, of course, a joker in the deck there, and that's all the Mexicans, the Hispanics that are now in the South as well. It could well be that there will be a race war in the South between the Hispanics and the blacks, which the Mexicans will win. And so it could be that the South will eventually become part of Aztlan. The rest of the country is going to be broken up into enclaves of various kinds. Our lifestyle is, and our economy is going to kind of probably at some point go back to almost a medieval level when the infrastructure breaks down. I believe that the white man has to take advantage of this breakup to grab a slice of the pie for himself. that slice of the pie that belongs to the white man and should remain in white man's hands should be here in the Pacific Northwest for a variety of political and moral and economic and demographic reasons, which I get into in the novels and so forth and so on. But basically, that is the whole thrust behind both my novels and the Northwest Front. We are going to establish a white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, let me ask you more pointedly, what specific indicators are you seeing that indicates to you that the U.S. is going to break up into a Soviet-style breakup? See, a lot of the fears that I have and other listeners have is that the Bolsheviks that have infiltrated our government are going to really clamp down even harder and use this chaos as an excuse to impose a red tariff on this country. That's what I see coming. So
they will try. They will definitely try. The question is, do they any longer have the competency to do that, or is the whole thing simply going to slip out of their fingers? Yes, you're right. There is an accelerating pace of 1984-style Big Brother-type tyranny. It's especially evident in the cities. TV cameras on every corner and in every building. The NSA spying on people and intercepting every email and every telephone call that people make and archiving it. Drones flying in the sky over the cities and, in some cases, the countryside, spying on people. And eventually, of course, the cops and the government are going to start sending attack drones after people. Matter of fact, there's some evidence that that's already been done here in the United States. I agree that they're going to try to impose a tyranny. There are those who kind of use this as an excuse to give up and do nothing. They say, the system is all powerful. They're all seeing. They're just going to destroy us, Harold. We can't do anything. Well, yeah, I mean, we're never going to win if we never try. But I don't think that they're going to be able to do it. I believe that the conditions in this country have just gotten to the point where they are so chaotic and so confused and so literally out of control. And there's also various points along the way in which this centralized tyranny can really come a cropper. For example, what's going to happen when they just plain run out of money and one day on the first of the month, all of a sudden the direct deposits to the EBT cards don't take place? They're going to have mass rioting. Do they really have enough loyal military force, put it that way, to where they can physically suppress mass rioting by millions of blacks and browns and poor whites who have become dependent on the government?
Well, Harold, that's a good point there. And I've brought this up myself, that any time the powers that be wish to institute great social unrest in any particular region or even coast to coast, they can target a specific city, they can target a state, they can target a region, like you said, the Deep South. And if they wanted to, all they have to do is not fund those EBT cards for that particular area. And if they do that, within 24 hours, you're going to have buildings on fire.
Well, that almost happened a couple of years ago in Georgia, where it was supposedly just an ordinary computer glitch that caused the Georgia EBT system to fail, and they actually had to practically airlift money into those Munkoids. But there were, the beginnings of a riot-type situation there. But there's all kinds of ways this system can and eventually will go down. The entire money system is about, it's just like a big, huge, overinflated balloon, and something's going to pop it. You've got the Federal Reserve basically printing money at will. They call it quantitative easing, but that's basically just another word for letting them printing presses roll. So either the EBT system will fail completely, or we'll have a situation where the money that people are getting paid with, all the government underclass that votes Democrat, and above all, the mercenaries, the police, the FBI, the military, the people who actually pull the triggers and enforce the will of this government, all of a sudden they're not going to be getting paid, and they're going to be scrounging in dumpsters and selling their weapons for food like the Soviet Army did in the late 1980s in Europe. And then there could be some kind of external threat. This lunatic Netanyahu in Israel could launch his bombers against Iran. We still could have this situation where the Strait of Hormuz ends up getting closed and we lose one-third of the world's exported oil. These lunatics could start a war in the Ukraine right now, which would
Harold, natural gas
being cut off.
Yeah. I hear our break music coming up, so we're at the top of the hour break. So we'll be right back in a few minutes more with Harold Covington right after the short break. And Harold, we've got an hour left after this, so I really want to get into these topics, and I've got my own thoughts I want your opinion on. I'll be right back, folks. More with author Harold Covington.
Okay, I checked my records. I actually played this in October of last year, which is maybe a little soon to be doing a rerun, but I just like it. This is the Tannehill Weavers.
Good afternoon and welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio, and today is Tuesday, May 27th, 2014. And after a very rough, technical, challenging start, we're back on with author and social commentator Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back to the show, sir.
Okay, I'm glad to be back. That was a wild interlude.
Well, yeah, they sort of spice it up on this. It's Revolution Radio for a reason, and I think they put their money where their mouth is. This is all listener-supported radio, which I kind of greatly admire because I've never made a nickel doing any radio shows at all. And so it's good to be with other people who sacrifice their time and effort for the greater good. And that's what this network is about. And that was a plug for them, by the way. Anyway, what I wanted to ask you about is there are a number of things going on. And, you know, because of Ukraine and because of Iran and the U.S. being bellicose to other countries around the world and being aggressive, you know, preemptive wars, this nonsense, it's really turned the whole global tide against the U.S. as a country. And I look at our foreign policy, and this foreign policy is foreign to me. It's alien. It doesn't come from the American people. It's not what the American people want. Most people are, in this country that I know of, are opposed to war or any further wars by about a 9-to-1 ratio. And yet we've got what I will call the Zionist occupy government that is dictating our foreign policy and really using the U.S. military as the blunt instrument of a foreign power, namely Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And this offends me. It's put this country at a greater risk than anything else that has happened or could happen. I look at the recent revelation that, you know, I'm an editor with VeteransToday.com, and we recently received a very massive intel dump from the Russian intel agency documenting what their analysis is of the 9/11 situation. And it came down that Israel took down the Twin Towers. And we find out that the U.S. presidency under Bush 41, Clinton, and then George Bush the Lesser has supplied over 350 U.S. surplus nuclear weapons, which were scheduled to be retired or instead stolen and proliferated around the world to probably 8 or 9 different countries, including Saudi Arabia, India, South Korea, Japan, Brazil. The list goes on. It's a list of 8 or 10 different countries that the U.S. has supplied, and they've used Israel as the broker to actually handle the transactions.
That does not surprise me at all. If I could just interject here, as you may have known, back in the early 1970s, I served in the Rhodesian Army, and we noticed at some point that a lot of the terrorist groups, the Patriotic Front, ZANU, ZAPU, etc., when we were going into their base camps and you know, whacking them out in the bush and whatnot, the RLI or whatever would hit the terrorist team, they were finding American-made weapons, M-16s, ammunition, white phosphorus grenades, and various items of American military equipment on the bodies and in the camps of these terrorist groups of black communists who were coming across the border and laying landmines and murdering people and so forth. And eventually, Rhodesian intelligence figured out that what was happening is the United States was loading Israel up with all kinds of just basically free small arms, including M-16 rifles, ammunition, grenades, M-203, M-40 grenade launchers, whatever. And the Israelis didn't actually need it, so America was just giving them all these weapons, and the Israelis were then proceeding to sell it to pretty much anyone who had the cash to buy it, and that's how American weapons were ending up in the hands of black terrorists in Zambia and Mozambique who were sneaking across the border and murdering white women and children, and a lot of black Africans as well, I might add. And so Israel is, I mean, that's just so, it's such an Israeli thing to do. They beg and plead for American aid, and America gives them the aid, and then they proceed to go out and sell it. So I can very well believe what you're saying there. I have no doubt at all that Israel would do the same with nuclear weapons if they got hold of any and they didn't happen to want them themselves to blow up Tehran or something.
Well, I think that may be on the list. One of the other revelations that came out of there is that Israel was brokering and absconding with See, these were U.S. weapons. We signed the START Treaty with the Soviet Union in order to reduce our nuclear stockpile. They would reduce their nuclear stockpile, and these weapons were to be decommissioned and retired. And yet under George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, instead of implementing the terms of the treaty, what they were doing is they were providing them to Israel, and Israel was marketing them around the world and lining the pockets of all three of those men who discredited the office of the presidency of the United States. But let me go my other point here. With the issues that are happening in Ukraine, now, I've been to Ukraine on probably 6-7 different occasions. I speak Russian somewhat, and I like the people there. Yeah, I got to meet Shuchu Paderewski. Anyway, it's a fascinating country. I've met very kind, very genuine, sincere people who want nothing more than to be left alone, go to work, make a living, provide for their kids, put food on the table and a roof over their head. That's the extent of their ambitions. And yet we have these Zionists in the U.S. We've got this Deputy Secretary of State, Newland is what she goes by. She was a Noodleman. She's married to a Kagan. And really, it's my premise that our entire government has been hijacked by these dual U.S.-Israeli citizens who have no loyalty to the U.S. at all. We're merely the tool that they're using to advance their Israeli-oriented goals.
Where you been? That happened 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, I know. But it's time that we address this on a daily basis. We address the treason that's been going on against this country. Really, in my lifetime, it was the murder of JFK. I was 9 years old. I was in fourth grade. I remember to this day when the announcement was made. But, you know, Johnson, who was a crypto Jew, was one of the instigators behind it, as well as Dulles, as well as, you know, a number of others. We had George H.W. Bush, who was at Daley Plaza the day JFK was killed. That man has probably a 50, 60-year history of working covertly, clandestinely within our own government, trying to subvert this government for his own purposes. And it's not just the Jews. We've got our own set of criminals, our own set of U.S.-based criminals here. And the Bush family, the Clintons, are right up there. These people are not fit for civilized company. But what's happening with this issue in Ukraine and how we're being misled, our foreign policy is being subverted to try to cause pain to Russia, it's forcing Russia and China to accelerate their cooperative agreement. China sees the threat that the U.S. provides to them. Russia sees the threat that the U.S. provides to them. And I think that the biggest thing that they could do was work with the BRICS nations to form an alternate reserve currency in the world. And if that happens, the value of the U.S. dollar is going to plummet overnight. And so what any foreign goods, like you go to like a Walmart right now, which I don't shop at, and the little knickknacks you buy there, you know, for $2 or $3, are going to be costing, you know, $20 or $30. And that's going to happen very, very quickly.
Well, that's one of the things I was mentioning earlier on in the program that could actually precipitate a collapse of the central government. As W.B. Yeats said, things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Take something else that might could aggravate it if they get this $15 an hour minimum wage going, and they're starting to do that here in Seattle. It looks like Seattle might be the first major city in the country to have a mandatory $15 an hour minimum wage, which is nice if you're flipping burgers, but the trouble is most small businesses simply cannot stay in business paying that kind of wage, because let's face it, you know, flipping burgers and cleaning grease traps isn't worth $15 an hour, because if you did that, your Big Mac would have to cost $13. People simply aren't going to pay that. And so I think the liberal and the Democrats, just pure sheer misunderstanding of how a modern technological economy works is going to act in our favor, because that could very well be a factor in introducing the kind of economic collapse where the almighty dollar is no longer holding this system together. And up until now, for many, well, hell, a couple of generations now, really the only thing holding America together has been the almighty dollar, and all of a sudden it ain't going to be so almighty anymore.
Well, let me make a couple comments about that, because, you know, since the beginning, I have never supported the minimum wage. I never have, and I never will. My first job, I was like 14, 15 years old. I was a dishwasher in a restaurant. I was being paid the minimum wage, which was $1.60 an hour at that time. I was probably worth about 90 cents, you know, because I wasn't the most productive worker. And we would not have this discussion about raising the minimum wage if we hadn't been interfered with on two fronts. One of those fronts was signing the free trade agreements of NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, all of those, which caused the mass exodus of U.S. industry overseas into China, Mexico, and other third world slave labor countries. Our government did that. That was a policy mistake. The NAFTA Accord was drafted when George H.W. Bush was president, and it was signed by Bill Clinton in 1997. And since that time, we have watched the exodus of over 60,000 U.S. factories close and move to China. 60,000 factories. And a factory is defined as any facility which employs more than 1,500 people. That's a small factory. Some of these are very, very large. Where I worked in Arizona with the Motorola organization, they employed over 27,000 people in that valley. And you know what? They're gone. They employ less than 500 people in the entire state now. So 27,000 U.S. jobs left when Motorola left. And this has happened 60,000 times across the country.
Where did Motorola go?
Motorola got out of the semiconductor business. They sold their interests to private equity firms. One was Texas Pacific Group. The other was a consortium of Blackstone, Carlyle, and I forget who else. And then they took the jobs that were in Arizona, and they moved them all to China. That, you know, I'm an expert on this. I can talk
that's
about
that. That's what I was after. I was wondering where the jobs eventually ended up.
The jobs ended up in China. And the other problem we have on wages in this country that no one wants to talk about, and that is this unrestricted flow of illegal immigrants into this country. And you have to remember, the reason people hire illegal immigrants is because they work for less than minimum wage. They will work for cash under the table. And even when they do get a paycheck and they have a fake Social Security card and a fake driver's license and a fake green card, even then, when they think they're paying taxes, they'll say, oh, I pay taxes on my wage. He thinks he did. However, the employer who hires him knows he's not legal. And guess what? He may withhold those taxes from his paycheck, but it doesn't mean they get paid. So really, the cost of hiring an illegal with known bad papers is a lot, lot less if you don't have to make the matching contributions, and you can pocket the employee contribution to FICA. You can pocket the employee's contribution to federal withholding and state. All of those things. So your $8 an hour minimum wage job is probably costing the employer about $5.30 because he's pocketing the balance.
Then again, you got to bear in mind also a lot of those employers could be doing this not because they're wicked, evil, white, exploiting thieves or anything like that. They're doing it because their business can't survive otherwise. I have noticed that the government just doesn't seem to want small business to exist at all, and the amount of regulation and BS that you have to go through in order to simply to run a small mom-and-pop store in this society now is just beyond belief. And running a successful business in America consists largely in acquiring the necessary skill set to get around the federal government of the United States and to keep some of what you earn. Because when all is said and done, it's not just the regulation and the bureaucracy and the mess, it's the fact that they simply take too damn much. You can't survive if you don't somehow evade taxes. Socialism is a destructive force in the world, and it's not all the invading armies of Stalin and Mao. It has this kind of destructive effect on the human spirit. Socialism is unnatural, and it forces men and women to do unnatural things, think unnatural thoughts, and live in unnatural ways. We're finding out in this country now as we're getting our taste for it. It warps the human spirit. It turns human beings into bad people in various ways. It is a totally destructive force.
This is Mike Cross.
Big old buzzard sitting on a fence watching them chickens play. He sit with his best friend, old Chicken Hawk. Chicken Hawk jump up and say, we ought to invite us a chicken home for supper today. And the buzzard looks at him with a baleful eye. Take a few seconds before he give a reply. He turn his neck nearly all the way around, and he points to the sky and he says with a frown, Lord will provide, the Lord will provide. Just be patient, brother, and the Lord will provide. The Chicken Hawk says, but I'm hungry. My stomach starts to rumble like a train. He spies a fat chicken in the barnyard. The Chicken Hawk jump up and scream. I hear the Lord helps him, it helps themselves, my friend. No, the Lord will provide. You know the Lord will provide. And as old Brother Buzzard said, the Lord will provide. Chicken Hawk starts to chase a chicken. Chicken starts squawking and run. The farmer come out of the farmhouse. Farmer got a big shotgun. The farmer, he blows that chicken hawk to kingdom come. And the buzzard looks at him with a baleful eye. Take a few seconds before he give a reply. He turn his neck nearly all the way around, and he looks at the chicken hawk laying on the ground. I knew the Lord would provide. I knew the Lord would provide. And that's what Brother Buzzard said, the Lord will provide. Yes, the Lord will provide, children. You know the Lord will provide. And that's what Brother Buzzard said, the Lord will provide. Lord will provide, children.
Okay, I'll finish up with that show next week rather than tack on another long segment here. I'm running long, but instead of a closing tirade, I have time for one quick email. This is from our old comrade Action Andy, who's now down in Portland. Dear HAC, so, after years of it collecting dust on my shelf, I have begun reading Imperium by Francis Parker Yaki. It's pretty interesting. I don't recall having heard you discuss that book much or the main ideas in it. It would be interesting to get your take on Yaki and his mentor in thought, Oswald Spengler. Actually, I would be interested to hear your thoughts on the traditionalist movements as well. Obviously, I am totally for the NF and the NAR, but how that is achieved, I think, will require a more organic worldview than what I think is being developed in white circles these days. Okay, first off, Imperium is a great book. It should be read by everyone, and it's on the party reading list, so get it and read it, all of you. It doesn't say anything that today's white nationalists don't know, but the reason we do know what we know today is because of men like Yaki back in the day. He was a great philosopher, great thinker, and we owe him a lot. He was one of the first who stood up after the war and restated the truth in a time when it was physically dangerous to do so, as witness the fact that Yaki was eventually murdered in a prison cell by the FBI. I tell you what, I lent out my copy of Imperium ages ago, and like virtually all racial books that get lent out anywhere, anytime to anybody, it never came back. If I can shake someone loose of a copy of Imperium, send it to me and I will send it to Gretchen so she can review it. In fact, she may already have read it, I'll ask, but I agree that we do need to pay more attention to the classics on here. That's why I do a lot of this older stuff, Huey Long and Father Coughlin, Gerald L. K. Smith, so forth and so on. But our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha on the Bon. Freedom.
Still is beating.